You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
Just a little while ago, I mentioned in one of these intros that it was just a matter of time before we got an election this summer. And I would take credit for being right, but everyone was right. We knew this was coming, and here it is.
After making it through 17 months of nothing like we've ever experienced, Canadians deserve to choose what the next 17 months, what the next 17 years and beyond will look like.
The question I want to ask today is why? Why are we having this election right now? Are there important issues that Canadians need to address this month? Or do we have a minority government that wants to be a majority government and thinks this is its best chance? Or both, I guess. It could be both. How often do governments actually get punished by voters at the polls for calling an election that very few Canadians say they want? How often does that get forgotten by, day six or so, as the campaigns pick up steam? And finally, since we're voting in September anyway, what can we do? What questions can we ask? What issues can we raise to make sure that we, as Canadians, get an election that really matters at a time when there really are some crucial debates that we need to have? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. David Moskrop is a political writer and commentator. He is, fittingly enough, the author of the book Too Dumb for Democracy. Hey, David.
Hello.
Why are we having an election right now? That's my first and possibly only question.
Do you want the charitable or the uncharitable take?
I want them both, but start by being charitable.
Well, the charitable case for an election is we have been through a pandemic. We have been through roughly the average life of a minority parliament in Canada. The Parliament of Canada, especially on the House of Commons side, has been moderately obstructionist compared to the usual, and the government feels that it needs to go to the people to check in on what it's done and to try to secure itself another go to implement the post-pandemic recovery plan. That's the ultimate charitable take.
It seems reasonable. That take seems very reasonable.
It seems extraordinarily reasonable. But, you know, in reality, it's much more the case that the Liberals want a majority government, full stop. They don't like dealing with the opposition in the House of Commons in a minority government situation. They especially don't like dealing with them at committee, where opposition members have significant influence, if not control, in committees and can cause all kinds of problems for the government, as we have seen in quote-unquote scandal or scandal after scandal. Mm-hmm. And they see a chance to potentially secure a minority government, and they're probably not going to get a better chance anytime soon. And otherwise, they're rolling the dice with the Delta variant, with future variants, and with the uncertainty that faces a fourth wave. And so now's the time to go. And I suspect the truth between the two is probably a mix of the best and worst case defenses of the election, with probably a slight bias towards the worst.
In general, in Canadian politics, how often does this kind of thing happen? I know that we saw it in British Columbia last year, but, you know, is this a traditional move, or is this something that people should feel grieved by?
Well, both. I mean, it's both common and irritating.
Fair.
The average government in Canada, I wrote about this a few years ago, in 2016, the average government in Canada since the Second World War lasted 3 years. Obviously, most majority governments go about four. The minority governments were closer to two and change. And so it was pretty common to see, it has been, roughly 2 years and a little bit, and then an election. Of course, the note here, the asterisk, or the caveat, is that's not true during a pandemic. It's extraordinarily unusual to have an election during a pandemic like this when it's not, strictly speaking, necessary. And that's the difference. You know, most people understand when you have to have an election 2 years and change into a minority parliament, it's different when it's in the midst of a pandemic. And if you look at most of the opposition to the election, it's stated as, we don't need an election during a pandemic. This was the same thing that people said about British Columbia, incidentally. Not all parliamentary democracies work in that way. You don't always have snap elections, although sometimes you do. So
that was going to be another question.
Yeah.
Is that a unique feature to Canada's system? What do other parliamentary democracies do, and how common are snap elections in those countries?
Well, so it would be uncommon to not have a snap election in a parliamentary democracy.
Right.
The fact is, this is utterly routine, not just in Canada, but in parliamentary democracies around the world, with a few asterisks again. One is New Zealand, after switching to proportional representation in the 1990s, saw far fewer, and perhaps none, by way of snap election. So that's one note, although that isn't to say that proportional representation means no snap elections, because there are snap elections under PR systems. Norway bars snap elections. It's unconstitutional to have a snap election in Norway. Once you're elected, you just have to sort it out. Coalitions in the legislature rise and fall, but that gets worked out amongst the coalitions, not amongst the people in an election. So it's a different model. Pros and cons, but it's a different model. So it's not uncommon to see this in Canada. It's typically what you see, although again, with the note that not during a pandemic.
We've heard a lot in the lead up to this election, as we've covered it on this show, that, you know, to your point, people just don't need it right now. They don't want it right now, especially during a pandemic. How often does that sentiment translate to a bad result for the government that calls the election? Do we ever punish governments for sending us to the polls?
We do. And, you know, most famously or infamously, people think of David Peterson in Ontario in the 1980s, who called an extraordinarily cynical snap election and lost government. But the fact is, for every David Peterson, you have a John Horgan. And we saw John Horgan call a snap election during the pandemic, in the middle game of the pandemic. So we were still worried about waves and vaccines and what we were going to do to mitigate future waves. And he won a majority.
Right.
And so the fact is that, sure, the election call itself is a sort of meta issue, but it's not going to remain the election issue. We'll talk about it for a couple of days, maybe a week. But then people are going to say, okay, what about childcare? What about pharmacare? What about disability rights? What about the climate? What about Indigenous reconciliation? What about anti-Black racism? What about taxes? What about et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And they're going to move on. So while there are plenty of instances of governments being punished, there are plenty of instances of governments not being punished. And so I suspect in this case, you're more likely to see the government not particularly punished, more like a Horgan than a Peterson.
When you look at the state of play, for want of a better term, in terms of all the polls leading up to this election call, should the Liberals be this confident that they're going to walk into a majority by calling a quick election?
I don't think. Well, look, I mean, there's a lot of Liberals, so there's a variety of different opinions and levels of confidence. I think the Liberal confidence narrative is more of a media construct than a representation of the state of the party. I think there are Liberals who are very concerned about their chances of certainly getting a majority and not willing to take government for granted. There are some who aren't, plainly, but I do think they're aware that there is always a risk when you go to the polls, especially during a pandemic. So I don't think the smart Liberals are overconfident. I think they know what they're dealing with. That said, I think they've looked at the probabilities, they've looked at the polls and said, this is as good as it's going to get. There's a risk here. There's a potential reward. And if you see the polls, the aggregates, the best polling firms, you know, hovering around 36% for the Liberals, high 20s for the Conservatives, 28, 29. That's not a bad deal for the Liberals, who say, okay, well, the worst case scenario is we end up kind of where we are. Hmm. the best case scenario is we get a majority. You know, really, they only need to add about 3 points on aggregate. Of course, it matters where those points are distributed. They've got to pick up areas of the country. Just because you've got, as Andrew Scheer learned in 2019, just because you've got good aggregate numbers doesn't mean that's going to translate into seats.
Right.
You can win all of Alberta, but still, and get more votes than the other party and still not form government, as Andrew Scheer did, almost all of Alberta. So I do think they're aware of that. But here's the other thing, and this often gets lost in the poll talk. Campaigns matter. They matter a great deal. We learned that in 2015. We saw that with Thomas Mulcair and Justin Trudeau. Mm-hmm. Campaigns matter. And I suspect the Liberals think they are better campaigners, they're better poised, and they can pick up 2.5 or 3 points in the right places and return a majority. In worst case, the consolation is a minority, which is there, which they already have. So they get a renewed minority.
Do they deserve, as a government, to be sitting in the position that they are right now in the polls going into this election? And I guess I'm asking that more in terms of, to use a sports metaphor, you know, have they been winning this game or have the opposition parties been losing it?
Well, I mean, I come at this from a particular perspective. You have to disclose off the top. I mean, I'm not a Liberal supporter. I'm a socialist. I'm not a supporter of any party, incidentally.
Right.
I'm a socialist who would like to see socialists elected. And so I never think that Liberal parties, small L or big L, deserve the polls that they get in a sort of normative sense. But if we do an imminent critique or an imminent analysis in the context of Canada itself, the fact is most Canadian voters, to the extent that they have ideological predispositions at all, coherent or otherwise, are sort of center, small L Liberals. And this government has secured a couple of really important policies. The Canada Child Benefit, although that goes back several years now. They managed the pandemic competently. Certainly, as a lot of people will look and say, look at the CRB, look at the wage subsidy, look at the business loan account, look at how they were able to procure vaccines. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if you look at the vaccine portfolio of the country, it is among the best in the world. You just can't deny that. You have to be such a partisan brain to think that Canada hasn't been a success on the vaccine front, with the one note that the actual shame of the vaccine procurement strategy has been to shut out, to some extent, the rest of the world, especially poor states, who now have limited access to vaccines and are paying the price. But domestically, it's been a good strategy. So all that's primed them for reward. Mm-hmm. And in the closing days of Parliament, they secured a handful of childcare deals that I think are very appealing to a lot of people, and for good reason. So I suspect that a lot of people are going to look at it and say, you know what? If we're comparing that to Aga Khan and SNC and we and, you know, selling arms to Saudi Arabia and things that I don't particularly care for, and I've got plenty of other critiques, but I think if most sort of small L centrist Canadians look at that, they'll say, it worked for me, and will be inclined to reward the Liberals, even though people like me would not be.
If you were a strategist for one of the opposition parties, then just given what you've just said about, you know, listing those scandals, and to your point, most Canadians probably don't care about them when compared to the domestic policies that are benefiting them. How would you then attack this government, knowing that, you know, the big scandals that you want to make headlines are probably not going to move that many votes?
Well, it certainly depends on which party.
Right.
I think. And on which things went wrong that led to me being a political strategist, both for myself and for the parties that would hire me. But I
should make you the Conservative Party strategist for this exercise now.
Well, for the Conservatives, here's the thing. I think the Conservatives are in deep structural trouble for the reason that they are far more fractious than people sometimes think. People talk about the left as being divided and difficult to govern and to hold together. The fact is it's the right. If you look at the contemporary history of Canada, it's the right that routinely fractures. Stephen Harper, to his credit, by the way, was able to come in and say, okay, I'm going to stitch this Frankenstein's monster together by God by any means necessary, and I'm going to hold it together, and he did. Mm-hmm. The problem is then he left. And subsequent leaders haven't been able to hold it together like he has, was able to, rather. And so the challenge of the conservatives is finding the next, 10% without reverting to appealing to the base, which is easy and cheap and maybe even satisfying, but utterly ineffective because it gets them nothing they don't already have.
Right.
And I, in fact, if I were a conservative strategist, I would say to Aaron O'Toole, you have two jobs. One, grab a hold of the reins of this party and run it like Stephen Harper did. Lock it down. I say this as someone who likes party democracy, likes open. I'm like, if you want to win, you got to lock these people down. You got to lock them down hard.
Hmm. You mean the base there you're talking about?
The party itself, the party caucus and the party influencers, and then the base is sort of secondary because the conservative base under Harper sort of fell into line. They learned to live with the fact that abortion wasn't going to be on the agenda, that same-sex marriage wasn't going to be on the agenda. Harper basically said, okay, that's settled in this country.
Right.
He moved on to the benefit of the conservatives. If they had stayed in the mud trying to relitigate those issues that are quite rightfully closed, I think it would have done him no good. And in fact, you saw that when he sort of reverted back to old form in 2015 with barbaric cultural practices and the hijab stuff, it served him really poorly because that's not what people wanted to talk about. And people rightfully saw that as deeply, deeply problematic. So I would say to O'Toole, you've got two jobs. Lock those folks down. Lock them down hard. Two, wait for Trudeau to trip over himself. it's received wisdom in this country that you vote out governments. You don't vote in governments. And I think that's broadly true. And so for the conservatives, I think it's a waiting game. I would also say to the party, you got to hold on to a leader for more than one election, or otherwise you're never going to get anything done. Stephen Harper was around for more than one election, going back to his early days. And for the NDP, I'd say broadly the same thing, but I would also add the NDP should be focused on getting new voters to the polls, not just trying to flip Liberals or Greens or the occasional conservative who might be on the fence or even, an undecided. I would say try to find new voters in the way that Justin Trudeau did in 2015. And do that by being unabashedly left.
In terms of voting governments out and not voting new ones in, is that why the Liberals can be so, I don't want to say that they're confident to your point earlier, but is that why that they can be so brash in terms of calling this election? Because they know that, in a time like this, Canadians would probably just prefer to stick with what got them through the pandemic. It's not that bad. And is that kind of who we are as voters?
That is who we are as voters, I think. Not universally, but largely, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the fact is the voters are not particularly partisan. They're not particularly politically engaged. I'm talking about on average. They are not ideological, which is different than partisan, right? I'm ideological, I'm not partisan. And they don't walk around with a coherent set of evaluative criteria and ideological checkboxes that they want to tick. They're good at what they're good at, their jobs, their hobbies, their sports, whatever, their family. They are trying to get through the day, and they're looking for good enough. Mm-hmm. And that's true of all kinds of countries. That's just true of how democracies tend to work. And then, of course, there are institutions that pattern behaviors. And ours have patterned ours in such a way that we tend to get Liberals more often than not. I mean, they're called the quote-unquote natural governing party, which is an irritating phrase, but the fact is they've governed more often than they haven't.
Right.
And what you typically see, if you look back through the history of the country, you see a long period of Liberal rule, then the Liberals blow it, the Conservatives govern for a couple of years, and then the Liberals are back. We default to the Liberals, and it's institutionally the case and long has been.
Well, I'll ask you to drop the cynicism then for a second. I know it's very easy to be cynical about this election. In an ideal world, we've got an election here. We're going to have 36 days or whatever it is to make a choice. what could this election be about? What kind of chances do we have in front of us?
Right. So I've just finished writing a piece about this, and I argue that this election is unnecessary, but nonetheless important. I mean, the fact is that whether or not you want an election, whether or not you think an election is necessary, independent of that, the fact is elections are important. They matter. And they are an opportunity to talk about things. And we typically do engage in policy debates. They're not the best always. They're marked by all kinds of partisan skullduggery, but there's still a policy conversation that happens. And I welcome that. I really do. And I think this can be an election about a handful of things, and will be. Chief among them, climate. The IPCC report of a few days ago was called a code red for humanity by the Secretary General of the United Nations. We're seeing it around the world. We know. So we could have another climate election. Every election from here on out has to be a climate election. Pandemic recovery. The fact is, we're slowly beginning to recover from the pandemic, notwithstanding the fourth wave and perhaps future waves. But we know that we're in a place where we can start to work on recovery. There's a real discussion about how we ought to do that, how we can do it equitably, who gets what, when, and how, to use an old line from politics. So, pandemic. And then, of course, the issues I mentioned earlier, which are still live issues, even though climate and the pandemic often overshadow them, there's still pharmacare, childcare, Indigenous reconciliation and justice, anti-Black racism, disability, tax policy, all kinds of things that are critically important, notwithstanding the climate debate and the pandemic recovery. In fact, and are part of the climate debate and pandemic recovery debate. So I think we can have a real important conversation about how we ought to do that and set the agenda over the next 6 weeks. And I'm going to be moderately optimistic in saying that I think there will be a bit of a robust conversation about that stuff, because the parties do differ to some extent on how to do things. I will say this, though. I do think, to some moderate extent, the vote will be a bit of a referendum on, have I been double vaccinated and can I sit on a patio and will I be able to do that for another couple of months? Mm-hmm. And I think the Liberals are counting on that.
How will we know what this election is actually going to be about? You know, you mentioned back at the beginning of this chat that the election is about, oh, we don't want an election for a very brief period of time. And then other things kind of take hold. What will you be watching for to see what's setting the tone for voters? And when will we get a sense of what's really going to matter when we go to the polls?
Well, elites set the tone. I mean, the truth is...
That's not encouraging.
No, it's not. But the alternative is... I should qualify that a little bit. Obviously, you can affect things from the ground up. And a lot of the issues that are percolating are percolating because people have been working on them. But the fact is, the election is going to be a reflection of what the parties choose to talk about and what the media chooses to cover and highlight. Mm-hmm. Because the fact is, there's a lot of stuff going on out there. And in any given day, we see a fraction of it. And that fraction is a reflection of what we're most likely to see because it's being covered the most or the most prominently.
Right.
And that's why the media and the parties have a huge, what we call agenda setting functions. And so it'll be up to them. And it's one of the reasons that as a columnist and writer, I try to talk about substantive issues in as much as I can in productive ways, because that's going to shape what people talk about. And that's a serious responsibility. And so I think, you know, we're going to see the usual horse race stuff, we don't need an election talk, the meta stuff, the horse race meta stuff. But then I really do think it'll be up to the parties to decide what they want to forefront. And I suspect it's going to be a mix of, again, looking back on the Liberal record, obviously, but looking forward to pandemic recovery, climate, and social policies around, I would say, mostly pharmacare and childcare. And here's the thing. If the parties and the media want to spend 6 weeks talking about climate, pandemic, childcare, pharmacare, as well as an Indigenous reconciliation, I think will be also top of mind. If they want to spend 6 weeks talking about, first and foremost, those issues, and then several others, as I mentioned, I would welcome that, you know, because here's the thing, we're already having those conversations.
Right.
Now we're going to have them under the sort of the hot lamps of an election. And I think that would be a credit to us. I really do. So I'm actually moderately optimistic we're going to have a fairly decent election, because, again, something has changed in the last couple of years, that there is there are rising consciousnesses in different communities and populations and in general about core issues that have been festering for a long time. And I think we're ready to have a big conversation about them, because we've already been having it. And I think that gives us a real opportunity to perhaps introduce some new perspectives, set the agenda, and maybe even some better policies. So ultimately, I don't particularly think we need an election, but if we're going to have one, I think we can and should make it count.
This conversation started with cynicism and ended with optimism, and I hope the election is the same way. We will maybe check back with you in a few weeks and see how you're doing with that.
Please do. That's my superpower. The cynicism to optimism swing, that sort of Nike swoosh or fish hook, is substantively valid, but also good marketing.
Well, thank you so much for it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
David Moskrop, political commentator, author of Too Dumb for Democracy, a book you can find wherever you get your books. That was The Big Story, a podcast you can find wherever you get your podcasts. You can also talk to us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can email us if you like. The address is TheBigStoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. We're also in every podcast player, on every smart speaker, and we really appreciate ratings and reviews, and especially real-life word of mouth. You can see your friends again, so tell them what you've been listening to. Thanks for choosing us. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.